outdoors, coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors,
beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors.
Hey, good morning, everybody. That's Inside Outdoors. This is Don Jordan talking to you here this morning. Buddy Bill's home in bed today. I'm here with Rich Reardon and John Ward. Say hello, Rich. Say hello, John.
Hey, good morning, folks.
Good morning. How you doing?
Hey, we're all doing okay. Rainy morning, though, eh?
A light rain at 50
light
degrees
rain.
Downtown in Bloomington. And we're going to have rain all day. Heavy rain, it says. And then showers likely, chance of showers tonight, and then we're looking at sunny, chance of showers towards Wednesday, and boy, I'm seeing those 50s in the future.
I'm seeing rain on Halloween.
Could be, yeah.
At least that's what the weather lady said this morning on Channel 6.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't get Channel 8 anymore on dish television.
Yeah.
Which I used to watch on a regular.
Yeah, you need to complain about that. they did that to me on DirecTV, and it took about a month before we got back to Channel 8 and 23.
Well, we just still don't have Channel 8 on dish over here. And, well, anyway. Other than that, things are great. Things are great. We got we're about to get into the gun seasons coming up here in November.
Yeah.
And, you know, November starts next week. Hard to believe.
Hard to believe.
Hard to believe. And
I don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
I guess we got no choice.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You can't change that.
No, you can't change that.
You can refuse to change your clocks, but you can't change the date.
Oh, don't even mention that part.
It's like you can tune a guitar, but you can't tune a fish.
You can tune a fish. Yeah. You might not catch any.
Okay, well, anyway, this morning, folks, we have a couple of news items to take care of here this morning, and one of them involves this large deer that was killed allegedly illegally
Putnam County.
Over in Putnam County, Greencastle man, and apparently charges were dismissed against him last week, and he had a whole bunch of them against him, and including trespassing, hunting without a license, shooting from an ORV, and we really don't know why the charges were dismissed. It didn't say so in the paper, and none of us have talked to anybody over there.
I plan to follow up on that this next week. My Owen County paper and the prosecutor's office is pretty forthcoming with information, whether I like it or not. But I'm very surprised with the amount of charges. The only thing I can think of is the value of the rack. Sounds incredible to me, but they may have made a deal on that.
Well, I the value of the rack is, it could be even more than what they pub the The paper said that it was worth $7,500. His fine was $4,500 for shooting this deer on somebody else's property from an ORV without a hunting license. About the only thing that I can think of why these charges would have been dismissed if there was something wrong in the procedure of the arrest. And they did get his cell phone and inspect it, so there had to be a search warrant involved someplace, and there's a lot of mistakes made in that area sometimes. So if that's the case, well, I don't, you know, it's hard to say whose fault it was.
Right.
But it was, if they dismissed the charges, it almost had to be in the chain of arrest and seizure of his materials.
Well, that makes sense. I can understand what you're saying. I don't like it, but I can understand it.
So anyway, just to bring you up to date on this, actually this story came out a couple of weeks ago. We didn't have time to get it on last week, but what's that I'm hearing? Oh, uh-oh. I see. Okay. It's the Angels.
I never get a call. I don't know why I'd get one now.
Well, somebody wants to talk to you about this deer, maybe.
That could be.
Okay, this guy's name was David R. McCullough from Greene County, or from Putnam County, and he's had five violations filed against him, including the intentional and illegal killing of a wild animal and intentionally hunting without a valid hunting license.
Hmm.
And according to the news release the DNR sent out, they obtained a search warrant to look at his phone and found that he had announced his intention to shoot this deer and to not get a hunting license. And then he did talk about, after he shot it, he texted somebody else, and then about a half an hour later, he went in and bought this hunting license, and all these charges were dismissed against him, and it's hard to believe why, and I'm sorry that we don't know why, but we'll find out for next week, I guess, unless somebody out there does know why. If there's any conservation officers around out there listening to us this morning, why don't you call us up? That's at area code 312-323-1200. That's 812-323-1200. And anybody can call in, actually. We welcome calls.
Absolutely.
So please do call in. And
well, apparently, if he's been arrested before, he didn't learn his lesson, because he did not have a license, according to the paper.
Intentionally. Yeah. Intentionally, and announced his intention not to get a license.
Yeah.
So, and hunting from an ORV is, yeah, everybody knows that's illegal.
Right.
And trespassing is definitely illegal. But so if he got off on all these charges, there must have been seriously wrong with the arrest procedure.
And it sounds like they had a pretty good line of investigation, so I don't see how they could have screwed up the arrest. But they could have. I understand.
I see it on TV all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
The littlest thing can let these
turn
guys
the whole case over.
Yes, let the criminals walk.
Yeah.
So I guess we can't call this man a criminal, because they did dismiss the charges. But we all know who you are, Mr. McCullough.
It sounds so bad.
Yeah. Well, in any case, that's the deal.
Yeah, that's where we are.
That's where we are. And other than that, this morning, there a little something came up about mussel shells. A guy posted a picture on Facebook of some mussel shells taken down at Lake Monroe, I think, little small shells. And the issue came up, well, are there any, have mussels disappeared, et cetera, et cetera. And I can tell you that no, mussels have not disappeared, although the harvesting of mussels has been curtailed. They stopped that. That's no longer legal to harvest the mussels. But they were nearly harvested into extinction several years ago. And they stopped, actually, in the 1970s, early 70s, they used to be able to use what you call a hookah, which is a air hose and a mask that you can get into the water with, and you don't have to have a scuba tank or, free dive. And that became illegal. And after that, they used what's called a drag bar, a big, long metal bar, maybe 10 feet long, that covered with hooks. And they dragged that through the mussel beds, and the mussels, having their clamp, their shells open in the current to get food, would clamp down on those hooks when the bar came by. And then they'd pull the bar up, and there'd be covered with mussels. That's how they used to.
I'll be darned. I did not know that.
That's how they used to do it. And, I have a good friend who used to be one of these.
Are you talking about Indiana, or are you talking
national? Indiana. Okay. I don't know what the national thing is. I'm sure they're in the same condition every place else. However, here's the interesting part. Do you know what they use these mussels for? Got any idea?
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't seem like you could eat them. They're so tiny.
Well, they might put them in the pet food.
No, they didn't use them for food. They didn't use them. They used them for one thing. They used them for seeding cultured pearls or oysters in Japan. And there are several different kinds of these mussels. Three finger is one of them, and they had a blue mussel because it turned blue when they cooked it to pop it open. And my buddy who did this said that out of the tons and tons of mussels that they harvested during the years they were doing it, that they only found four or five perfectly round pearls in any of these mussels. He said you would find inclusions, that's what they call them in the freshwater mussels, but they were usually shaped like a tooth or a stalagmite or something. They were not round, so you couldn't use them as pearls. But out of those tons and tons, only four or five round ones that could be sold.
That's amazing. Now, I guess by the type of preparation they would go through to put a pearl start in the mussels, that must have created a better pearl.
Well, they seeded them because you couldn't depend on the oyster itself to seed itself. And you know, you've seen those pictures of the Japanese girls, the pearl diver girls that was made famous in one of the James Bond movies. They would dive, they were free divers, they would dive down onto the oyster beds, pry the oyster shell open a little, and insert one of these seeds under the mantle of the oyster. And from that grows a cultured pearl. That's the reason they call them cultured. They're grown. And those are most of the pearls that your wife may be wearing around her neck are cultured pearls from Japan. And the real pearls are beyond sight on price, and you probably don't own any.
a natural occurring pearl.
Right, yeah. One that's self-seeded.
Yeah.
But
do the small mussels from Indiana get large enough to make a pearl oyster?
Oh, well, some of these pearls, or some of these oyster mussels in Indiana are incredibly large, bigger than your hand.
Oh, okay.
Just so happens that the ones you usually see along the bank are young ones.
Okay.
You know, that have died.
They would even buy the young ones to grow for pearl?
No. They're just buying the
large
shells. They take the shell.
Okay.
The shells are shredded into little pieces, and those are the seeds that they sell.
Okay.
And some of the seeds from some of these mussels were quite valuable. And if you were to get an actual round natural pearl out of an Indiana mussel, it might go for $40, $50, $60, which is seems not very much, but that's quite a bit if you're a pearl hunter.
Yeah, that's quite a bit.
But if you only get four or five of 20 years of pearl hunting, that's probably not going to keep you in business.
No, I'd say it'd be pretty slow return.
I forgot my little piece of paper with the names of all these mussels on them this morning, but There are many different types. That's all I can say. There's at least five or six different types that were harvested here. Yeah. And according to my buddy, he says that the beds are still there, that they have not been eradicated. It's just that there's no legal harvesting anymore. So we don't really know.
Okay.
We don't really know.
That's for protection of the species.
Right. Exactly. Okay. And, some places, there's a few places I know there are still some mussels around, and boy, I collected just walking in the creek and picking up dead ones, some very large ones, very large.
Okay, I've found several small ones. Uh-huh. I haven't run across large ones.
Well, there you go. They're still out there, but since they're not harvested anymore, at least legally. We don't know.
Okay. And, well, that's interesting. It's worth driving in here this morning just to learn all that. I appreciate it.
Well, actually, when Rich told me about you had sent him this article last night, I was looking at Facebook at the time, and by there, here's this thing about mussels pops up. And
that's interesting.
I called my friend over in Greene County who used to do this with his dad and his brothers, and he's full of information about it, and gave me more than I wanted to know.
Well, now is it still legal in other states? Or
I have no idea.
We don't know. Okay.
I have no idea.
Okay.
But it's definitely not in Indiana.
Okay.
And it's not practiced anymore. So you can still probably go to those places where you might have seen some in the past, and you ought to see them now.
Yeah.
You ought to see them now. Huh. I mean, I got mussel shell ashtrays. That's the most common use I've had for them when I used to smoke, anyway.
Well, I've got clam shells stored, but it's from clams I bought at the grocery store. So
yeah.
That doesn't count.
Well, that clam business, of course, I used to live in Florida, and they grow clams commercially down there now in little trays in a building. There's still clamming going on out in the saltwater, but out in the ocean or the Gulf of Mexico, actually. But most of the clams you get these days are growing in trays inside a building.
Right, right.
They're good. They're not...
Right. The food's fine. It's just, it's not a natural occurring thing.
Right, right. Well, there you go.
Hey, we got a caller. We're just about to take a break, but let me just get him on anyway, just for the moment. And
okay.
It is Dan. How are you doing, Dan?
Hey, Dan.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I am enjoying the discussion. Hey, I wanted to add something to the whole discussion about mussels. I got a movie out of the public library a few years back, and there's a local man, used to be a local man, named Dylan Buston.
Oh, yes.
Kind of known for music. So he did this documentary as a young graduate student. I want to say it was probably...
Hey, I'm going to have to stop you for a second. Just hang on here. You just happened to call in during the break, so hold on for a second. We'll be right back.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Listening to Inside Outdoors, brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills of southern Indiana. So hang in there, and we'll be right back with more Inside Outdoors after this short break.
This is WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. And as we said just a little bit ago, it's light rain, 50 degrees down here. Not too bad, but we're going to have showers all day. And then it's going to become sunny, mostly sunny all the way up into Halloween, looking like mid-60s to upper 50s towards the mid of the week. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Outdoors.
My heart goes where the lutefisk go. I jump in my boat and I row, row, row. The lobster, the halibut, the codfish too. They don't taste good like the lutefisk do. They don't taste good like the lutefisk do.
Be good carp bait. You know, they're not good to eat.
The elephant. It's a national dish in like Scandahoo. The elephant.
I bet they don't smell good.
The elephant. Yeah, they eat that lutefisk.
Oh, would you?
Yeah, it smells like rotten meat. Yeah, it just brings the insects in from miles and miles around. They still eat it up in the Northland.
That's pretty good. I like that. Rich ain't laughing.
I didn't
He's
laugh
still
that one.
About that.
No.
He's
well,
not laughing.
Maybe he does.
Yeah.
All right, we're back.
Hey, everybody, get a little biscuits and gravy yet this morning?
I don't know. Well, yeah. Let's ask Dan. Dan, are you still there?
Or lutefisk.
I'm just having my biscuits and lutefisk here.
That's great.
Did you ever eat lutefisk, Dan?
I've never seen that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I used to live in Superior, Wisconsin.
I can't believe they call that food.
Well, you know, that a lot of people actually like it. So, you know, it's one.
I got this idea that sometimes it's all you have around, so that's what you settle for.
Well, that's the only way they had of preserving these fish.
Oh, yeah.
So, actually, they preserved them with lye.
That's right.
They used lye to preserve these things. So, you know.
Well, if you're starving in the middle of the winter, it's probably as good as you can get it.
It's right. Better than starving.
Right.
Probably not going to find too
speaking
many
of lies,
taters.
Speaking of lies, So back to Dylan Bustin. Okay, so
yes.
He finds this guy that's over on the Wabash, and I want to say it's late '60s maybe.
Yeah, that was when he was around here.
So there's a real gem in this documentary film. It's not a good production. It's real crude, but he's got this guy sitting out on the water, and he's got a whole bunch of these little. It kind of reminds me of lobster pots that you see up in Maine for lobsters, you know. He's got little floating things where he can find them. But what he's doing, he's picking up oysters that are in the Wabash. And you get pretty far along in the film, and he's got pearls that are in these oysters, and he shows them to you. You know, the camera's there. And then they don't beat the dead horse about the pollution, but he basically says, I'm not getting any more because the river's gotten polluted. And it was the end of that time, and that, I think Dylan Bustin had the good sense to find this person who had been doing this all his life and record it, and there have not been, as far as I've never even heard of, freshwater pearls, especially not in the Wabash, but it's in this movie. As far as I know, it's still over there at Monroe County Library.
Well, you got any idea what the name of it is? How did you find it? What, you know?
Well, I would look up Dylan Bustin, and then I would say it was something like, I want to say it was called The Pearl Hunter or something like that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Maybe a reference to pearl, because yeah, that's the guts of this film, and it was this had a real strong impression on me. But I enjoyed hearing you talk about these guys you knew that have spent their lives picking up the mussels and this idea culture, you know, using the, I guess it's the little animal in there that they put in the...
No, they take the shell itself.
The shell itself,
The
okay.
shell itself, and they had some kind of a machine they ran the shells through, and it made little bits.
Okay.
Little bits of this shell that they sold to the Japanese to seed the real oysters.
Okay, I heard the word seed, and Don, you know what it made me think of was they will take a grain of sand and put it inside
right. The
oyster to get the pearl to grow. And I don't know very much about it, but you're just interfering enough that you're stimulating it to do this thing.
Yes, well, that's the reason why the shells were so popular, because it worked a lot better than a grain of sand.
Well, and they were cultured then, right? You don't want an uncultured.
That's right. They had a lot of culture. They probably all went to Harvard.
Hey, I got to throw one other thing out here. I heard about the deer and the man in Putnam County. So one day I meet this fellow over. I was over in maybe around Duggar or somewhere, and I kind of remember being in a store, and I meet this conservation officer. And he's off duty, and you know, it's just real mellow, and we're just talking about things. Well, I bring up the subject of people hunting ginseng, and what do you do when you catch them? And there isn't really very much in the law to there's not any serious jail sentence or anything for that. And he kind of listens to that, and he says, well, we have this thing. When we have somebody on an infraction, which is a really minimal category of crime, we can still take all their stuff.
Right.
Anything that's being used in the commission of even an infraction.
Yes.
Thinking like, oh, illegal parking, you could take his SUV. If it's, you know, if that's all the power you have as an officer. And so then I thought about it. Okay, somebody that's out shooting a deer from an ORV, you can take his ORV.
That's right.
Done. And you don't have to apologize for it. And he doesn't have any right to it, because in the commission of the crime, he's using these things. So that made me think of that when you... Maybe the guy didn't get jail time, but hopefully they took his own.
Well, here's the thing. If they dismiss the charges, he gets that all back.
You're right.
And they not only get your car, they get your rifle, they get your fishing pole, they get your boat, whatever you had on the scene where you were doing this. They get your ORV. They get the deer, they get the antlers, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, I'm sure that if these charges are dismissed against this man over in Putnam County, he's got all of his stuff back. And I really am interested in knowing what happened there. And I promise you, we'll know by next week.
Yeah, I think we're both going to follow up on what went on there, because I'm very curious. And I followed up on a case about a year ago through our little paper over there in Owen County. And they ended up with saying there wouldn't be any restitution because it was all covered. And when I called about it, within two or three weeks of investigation, there's $25,000 restitution assessed on the perpetrator. So I think we can get a little more understanding of this.
Well, $25,000 restitution sounds like a fine.
Yeah, well, the fine that I read was $4,500.
Now, that's not much for...
No, that was for the killing the deer. Like, that's what they said the deer was worth.
Yeah, he sounded like he wanted the rack and...
Absolutely.
You know...
Well, it's a big rack. It was like a 14-pointer or something.
It was a giant.
Yeah.
Giant rack.
Well, you know.
Hey, well, carry on, boys. I always enjoy the show, and hopefully Bill's listening at home and recuperating or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for calling in, Dan. Yep. Always good to hear from you.
Thanks, Dan, and we hope Buddy Bill's back real soon.
All right.
Thanks
have
a bunch.
Good day, gentlemen. Thank you.
Bye bye. Okay, so there's a lot of interest in this deer.
Well, it's a story of consequence, even though it's a pretty local situation for Owen County and Putnam. It's a big deal because of the size, and to me, it's a big deal because of the number of charges that ultimately got dismissed.
Well, any time that the DNR manages to catch one of these poachers and arrest them, it's a pretty big story, because it doesn't happen very often. Maybe it happens more than we hear about, but I don't think so. We probably would hear about it.
Well, our little local paper, which I very much respect in Spencer, had an article that pretty much was a quote from what you talked about the week before on the show about what could be the problems with butchering a deer this year because of the things that exist. It was a good, long article. And also something that caught my attention, there's a serious decline in our local area to deer licenses and hunting licenses, which a lot of people don't realize that don't hunt. That money funds a heck of a lot of conservation.
I'm glad you brought that up, John. That's absolutely right. And that deer hunting license sales number has been going down for a number of years now. This is not new. It's been in decline for at least 10 years. And the last few years, it's picked up a little speed. And yes, I was talking to my wife about this the other day. A lot of people do not realize.
Especially non-hunters.
Yes, but even hunters.
Yeah, even hunters.
When you buy a fishing license or when you buy a piece of equipment, let's start with the equipment. Let's say you buy a boat. Let's say you buy a tent. Let's say you buy a shotgun or a fishing pole. A federal tax is on every one of those items. That federal tax goes to Washington, D.C., where it's collected together and added to and then redistributed to the states through the Sport Fish Restoration Fund and the Wildlife Restoration Fund, which were passed by Congressman, or yes, I guess he was a congressman, John Dingell up in Michigan. He was the guy who was responsible for these things some time ago. And there's been millions, maybe billions of dollars collected that go back to the states. Now, the state of Indiana never tells us how much they got.
Right.
They never tell us what they do with it. And I have asked many times over the years, and I have never got an answer out of them. So it makes you wonder if they're actually spending this money for sport fish restoration and wildlife restoration. And your fishing licenses also and hunting licenses go into funds that are supposed to be, well, we always thought, spent on fish restoration and wildlife restoration or doing something to help them out. But I know for a fact that a lot of money collected, especially these lake, you know, the lake enhancement fee, you know, you remember that?
Right.
That you now get added to your boat registration every year. The way they count lake enhancement, it's building new boat ramps or putting in new docks. There's nothing about helping the, you know, a new boat ramp does not help the fish.
No, and it doesn't help the lake.
Does not help the lake. It increases the number of people and the number of amount of pollution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if you want to set me straight on this, I'd like to hear from you.
I wish somebody that knows what's going on could call in and explain that, because I think that's the worst part of any tax or fee is not knowing how it's spent.
Well, it's their secret little fund.
I'm hoping that's not always true, but you may have a very valid point.
I actually called the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because they're the ones that distribute the money, and asked them, well, how much money did Indiana get? And their answer was, well, we lent the states release that information. But, you know, if you filed or wrote, you know, if you write a letter and quoting the Freedom of Information Act, they must release this information. I just never, that was at a point in my time when I quit working at the newspaper and really didn't want to look it up. But the information is there, and it's our information, and we have a right to it, no matter how much the DNR or anybody else wants to keep secret. We do have a right to this information.
Well, I agree that's something that we need some response on, that even if it's in percentages or whatever, to kind of show how that's working for wildlife, fish, and the environment, instead of just knowing that X amount of dollars is collected.
Well, that's another thing that you need to know is that money spent on wildlife and fish helps all the other species too. It doesn't help just the hunted and fished species.
Right.
And your birds and non-game wildlife, allegedly non-game wildlife like otters, animals like that, foxes. I saw a fox this morning on the way in, by the way.
That's pretty good luck.
And
should be good luck anyway.
That money is pretty much crucial to maintaining a lot of wildlife. And
and you're right. Not only non-hunters, but I probably bought hunting and fishing licenses for 10 or 15 years. I'm 73, so that's a long time ago. But I probably bought them for that long, not realizing the chain of investment.
Right, and hunters and fishermen, this is the only case that anybody has ever been able to cite where citizens asked to be taxed. That's where these taxes arose. And this was back in the 50s when things were so bad. You know, there were no deer here. There were no deer in Illinois. There were no deer in Ohio. The fishing was terrible because everything was polluted. And we are the only group of people that actually asked to be taxed to help out the situation. And that's where this came from.
Yeah.
And, it's been there for a long time, and it's brought in a lot of money. I'd just like to know how it's spent, but nobody.
Well, I'm all for it, but I agree with you on we ought to know where it's going.
Well, in any case, I hear music in the air, and I guess we have a break coming up. So
I bet we do.
Before we have a few minutes, I guess, or a minute or so, whatever.
I don't know. We're not getting any signal yet.
I'm just going to report on a DNR news release: conservation officers investigating accident up at Prairie Creek Reservoir in Delaware County, where a guy died. The victim was named Leonard Anderson, a 71-year-old man from Muncie, recovered from the water by witnesses. Efforts to revive him were unsuccessful, and he was pronounced deceased at the scene. He was ejected from the boat he was operating after a collision with another vessel. This happens too much. Witnesses indicated that he may have had a medical emergency before the accident.
Hey, we're out of time.
That's all we need.
We'll be
to
right
say.
Back.
You're listening to Inside Outdoors, brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills of southern Indiana. So hang in there, and we'll be right back with more Inside Outdoors after this short break.
This is WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. Still light rain downtown, 50 degrees right now. And today we're going to see heavy rain most of the day, 100% chance of rain rest of the day. Going to become sunny tomorrow and mostly sunny on Monday. Mostly cloudy on Tuesday and going into Wednesday, which I believe is Halloween. I know it's somewhere in the middle of the week, but it's going to be some more showers coming our way and getting a little bit colder up into the upper 50s. But next few days should be pretty nice. Highs around 63 on Sunday. Monday, 67. Anyway, you're listening to Inside Outdoors. We'll be right back.
It ain't a bunch of beans they serve in the Navy. It's bacon and eggs.
Biscuits and gravy.
Biscuits and gravy, bacon and eggs. Whole pot of coffee down to the dregs. When I get out of bed, my belly big. More biscuits and gravy, bacon and eggs. That's biscuits and gravy, bacon and eggs.
Yeehaw!
Well, you got your harp out.
I got the old Bruce harp out.
We had the Don on that, baby.
Yes, sir. You can't beat the Bruce harp. That's the only instrument that a non-musician can play.
Yeah.
So anyway, everybody, I'm glad you're back. I hope you got your biscuits and gravy, your bacon and eggs. Had a big pot of coffee. I got Mike's coffee sitting right here this morning. I hope you do too. Had to have a swig.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's nice and warm. And I got a couple of other DNR news releases about accidents. And these other two involve ORVs, I believe. Let's see. Where are those? There they are. Okay. There's tree stand accidents. That's what they are. Okay. This is a fall from tree injures Whiteland man. This was a couple weeks ago. This happened in Morgan County. Tree stand accident injured Bradley Wise, age 33, of Whiteland. Climbing ladder to tree stand, Wise got to the last step of the stand, began getting dizzy, and passed out. When he awoke, he was laying on the ground in extreme pain, I bet. After about 20 minutes, he was able to reach his cell phone. Well, there's one of the only good things about cell phones, in his pants pocket, and get help from a friend who was hunting the same property. Investigation revealed the fall was 12 feet. That's a pretty long fall. At the time of the fall, Wise was wearing a safety harness, but it was not attached to a safety lanyard.
That's not much good.
A similar accident happened earlier this year. Wise was transported to Memphis Hospital. Lifeline sustained injuries consisting of multiple broken bones and spinal fractures. Oh my. That was Morgan County Sheriff's Department responding to that. And then we got another tree stand injury. Let me get that out of here. That's Fremont man injured in tree stall up in Steuben County, or Steuben, as they say, county up there, named after Von Steuben, the guy who whipped the Revolutionary Army into shape at Valley Forge. That's what that county's named, who that county's named after. Anyway, tree stand fall that occurred probably 7:30 in the evening up off of State Road 120, if you know where State, there seems to be a lot of action up there on that State Road 120. Matt Goins, age 34, of Fremont, was hunting from a tree stand in a wooded area behind his residence wearing full safety harness, unhooked tether from the tree to climb down. And when he stepped on top of a set of climbing sticks, the strap became dislodged. He fell approximately 20 feet to the ground.
Ouch.
Wow.
From the base of the tree, Goins called his wife, and then she called 911. He was transported by ambulance to Parkview Regional in Fort Wayne for treatment. Conservation officers were assisted by the Fremont Fire Department and the Fremont Police Department in Steuben EMS. So they had a lot of people out there. With Indiana's deer season now open, COs remind hunters to always wear a full-body safety harness, a lifeline system to prevent falls, and make sure you hook the lifeline up. You know, it's just really incredible.
Well, to unhook the safety harness, it is no longer a safety harness.
That's right. It is not a safety harness if it's not hooked up.
There was a younger fella that's in the congregation of a church I attend that was injured in a tree stand accident and fractured his back, and some of the bone fragments have caused problems with spinal fluid, and he's in pretty tough shape, and he's younger than the people you mentioned.
Uh-huh, yes. Well, they're all ages. In fact,
right.
And way back before the bow season started, I had mentioned on air that a young man had fallen from a tree stand, and I said that was the first one. A friend in Florida heard this show, and he sent me an email saying, well, there's actually two, because my cousin fell from a tree stand the same day up near Fort Wayne and got injured. And
well,
so,
I'm sure there's plenty of them we don't hear about because reported.
Well, if you're not hurt too much, I'm sure you'd rather crawl out of the woods than be humiliated.
Right. Friend of mine fell out of a tree stand, landed on his coffee thermos, and he was certain he'd broken his back, and turned out he didn't, thankfully, but the warm coffee spilling on him scared him to death.
He thought he was bleeding.
And he crawled for about half a mile to his truck before he realized it was coffee. That's a true story. Yeah. He told it on himself.
That's pretty good. Well, I got to say, you know, this falling, I was talking about this to someone last night. Back in around 2000, I fell off a ridiculous ladder setup that I had. I only fell 4 feet, but I landed on just the wrong way, and I broke 4 ribs in the back, along my back.
Yep.
And they separated about an inch, inch apart.
That's
and they're
a big
still
break.
They're still apart.
Right.
And
The
radiologist who gave me my x-rays, he sees these every day apparently, and he had broken his ribs, and he told me, he says, "You're going to feel that for the rest of your life." And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, if you break your ribs, you actually break them. We're not talking cracks or bruises.
Right.
If you actually break your ribs, you are going to feel that for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I feel it sitting here right now. So when you get on a ladder, make sure that ladder is well fixed on the ground.
Well, I'll tell you, when I turned 62 or 3, I started putting a rope around my ladder, not my step ladder, but my extension ladder, and tying it. Now, I know I'd still get beat up if I slipped, but at least I wouldn't fall backwards on my head or back. And I have cracked a couple ribs, so I know what that feels like. But I never separated them an inch apart. That's pretty damaging right there.
Well, it was so bad that when I had an MRI, there was a shadow of these ribs on the interior of my body, that would be my chest cavity, up against the inside of my skin of where these ribs.
Well, they say the problem is the damage they can do to the front part of your body.
Oh, man.
Even if you break them in the back.
Well, it's a serious thing to think about having a fall. So if you're in a tree stand, I wouldn't recommend a tree stand for anybody
I never hunted from a tree stand. I didn't like them.
They're the best, probably. I don't know
possibly.
That they're the best. But, the danger of a fall. And a few years ago, there was a bow hunter that had climbed a tree stand, fell out of the tree stand, didn't have his safety line. And he had his arrows and ran an arrow into himself.
Yeah.
And I don't remember whether he died or not, but you could easily kill yourself.
Easily.
And also, there was a guy hunting with a muzzle loader, and he had his muzzle loader loaded and cocked when he climbed the thing and then pulled it up with a rope like he was supposed to, but it fell out, discharged, and shot himself.
Well, you got to follow some common sense safety recommendations. I think the harness is a great thing for these people, but I mean, climbing with a loaded firearm or hauling a loaded firearm that's cocked to you is absolutely against every common sense safety notion.
And climbing the tree with a quiver full of razor
broadhead
arrows is not a good idea either. So you could probably get away with carrying your bow up there, you know, but I wouldn't even do that. I'd haul them up after I got up there.
Right, and they make the carriers now that cover the full end of the arrow.
Right.
So you could pull one of them up on a line without having a lot of worry. Or even if you had to climb down with that on, that would be a protection. But if you don't have that... It's like carrying a knife aimed at yourself.
Well, that's right. Not to change the subject, but you may remember a few weeks ago there was an article that came out from the DNR, a news release, that saying that that the fish stocking practices were going to change in Indiana. And,
right. And I remember you discussing that.
And there was a little. There was a little teaser in there about walleyes and et cetera. Well, if you read into that a little farther, and then this other one came out, I'm going to read to you here in a minute. you find that there wasn't any change in the walleye stocking at Lake Monroe. They're not going to stock any walleyes or wipers at Lake Monroe anymore, other than what they have been, the leftovers from other places. And they're going to concentrate on trout stocking. Of course, we don't get any trout stocking.
Well, yeah, how's that help us?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't help us. But you know who it does help is Lake Michigan. So here's here's the DNR announces Lake Michigan stocking increase. Okay.
Excellent.
The new interim plan comes in response to recent Lake Michigan Committee recommendations to increase lake-wide stocking levels. Data indicates predator-prey balance in the lake has improved, and the size of the salmon out there certainly supports it. Now, I'm not buying that, because you still can't get, you still can't go up to Lake County, except maybe one or two places, and buy, you can buy farm-raised perch, but you can't buy those perch that get the fishermen, commercial fishermen used to haul out of Lake Michigan, because they're gone. The trout have all eat them. You know, these are Chinook king salmon, the people who don't like to call them Chinook. And they get to be quite large. They can be 20 pounds, and they're like freight trains. They're really fun to catch, et cetera, et cetera. But, boy, they eat a lot of small fish, and that's also caused a big decrease in the alewife population in Lake Michigan. That's what they're saying has rebounded. Well, I'm not so sure I believe them, but I guess you know, we'll find out, because the other fish suffer when the alewives are gone.
Every time we monkey around with the balance of nature, there's an unintended consequence that nobody knows about until we see the results.
Absolutely. And
sometimes it's years later, but it may wipe out a whole species.
Well, that's true. And that came up in another instance. There was a recent story about frogs in Yellowstone National Park, and how that they're rare now. And not too long ago, I did a story about the decrease in amphibians around the world, and talked to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service retired agent. And apparently, back in the 50s, there were still lots of frogs, especially in the high-altitude lakes.
Right.
You know, 8,000, 10,000 feet up in there, where today there are zero frogs. And the reason for that was the stocking of brook trout and rainbow trout and other fish into those high-altitude lakes. They ate all the frogs. They ate them all. And so if you're looking for a culprit on frogs in those kinds of situations, don't look any farther than yourself. You know,
yep, that's what I'm telling you, unintended consequence.
And these guys went to great, great trouble to pack those trout up to these high-altitude lakes on mules in wooden kegs, trying to keep them alive, keep the temperature below 70 degrees. To get those trout up there to eat all those frogs. I guess they thought they had a frog. Of course, they didn't realize at the time.
No, they didn't know they were taking care of the frog population by bringing in the trout. But that's what I'm talking about. When we make these environmental decisions, we're trying to play God here, and God already had it figured out, and we're messing around with it.
Well, and certainly there are unintended consequences. And, of course, that's what's going on in California with the wildfires.
Yep.
Well, when you're a city manager and you're thinking about increasing your tax base, boy, that 2,000-house subdivision up there by the edge of the National Forest looked pretty good. But once it starts burning, it doesn't look so good anymore.
Right.
You know, and it's costing us billions and billions of dollars.
And we're going to turn all the power off, because that'll protect us against forest fires, except it doesn't.
Well, it didn't, did it?
It didn't. Okay.
And it's not going to.
No.
But, you know, I can, they
I'm
got
blamed.
I'm
not saying it's a bad idea. I'm not saying maybe it's not a bad idea. I don't know. But it's not going to stop. What's going to happen?
Pacific Gas and Electric was blamed for the what was it, the Case Fire? Or
the big one.
The one last year.
Yeah. One in Paradise, yeah.
It was blamed for that.
Right.
Well, maybe they did, but so they're being extra careful. You can't blame them.
No.
But, of course, like I think Rich mentioned this last week or somebody did, you shut off the electricity. What do you do if you don't have any light? You light a bunch of candles.
Right.
Well, now, don't you think that might be a little more dangerous than your electricity? I don't know. Well,
it could be.
If you find yourself suddenly in the dark this morning, you may light a candle because it's raining like beat the bane out there.
It's going to rain all day.
That's right. And here's a throw out to Bill this morning.
Yes.
Buddy Bill, you get better soon. Have Clarice get you some of that good chicken soup. You can, you know, I know you got lots of chickens. Yeah. I know you don't want to kill any.
I want you back in.
Well, hey, that's about it for today. I appreciate you guys coming in, and we'll see you all next week.
I'm happy to
Thanks
visit.
For listening this morning.
All right.
Have a good one, folks.
See you next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show.
So thanks, everybody, for listening and tuning in this morning. And so we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.